Well, I promised you a special guest as we kick off Over Coffee, and guitarist Dave Oste is in studio with me right now. Dave, welcome.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
It is great to have you. I'd love to start your story at the very beginning. Can you tell me, when did you first realize that music was what you really wanted to do?
Well, basically, I just literally one day walked out of the classroom at school and I just started playing guitar, and I wrote a song that morning, and I just turned over a metal trash can back when metal trash cans were all the rage, you know. And I sat on it and started playing the song for my friends, and immediately got in trouble with the school in one way. They said, you can't do that, but eventually they let me start playing the last 10 minutes of every class because I just wouldn't stop playing. And it's a long story, but I was out of school by seventh grade, and they said, you know, either the guitar has to go or you got to go. And I said, well, I'm going with my guitar.
Sounds like a great choice to me. With that kind of negative reaction from your school, even though you were very creative, what nurtured you and what kept you going as a musician, as an artist?
Well, I never thought I was going to be a musician. I wanted to be a drummer. That was my first inkling of wanting to play music at all. And I was the snare drummer for the school band while I was there. But they put me in the advanced class. I mean, they put me in a ninth grade class, and I was seventh grade. And I got in trouble doing that, too, because I started making up my own drum riffs, and then the school administrators wouldn't approve them, but they were way better than what the school guy was writing. I mean, he was writing some really dorky riffs at the time. We didn't want to play them. We wanted to play our stuff. And then shortly after that, I took a bus to the Ice House in Pasadena because I liked Jim Stafford, who did Spiders and Snakes.
Oh, yeah.
And I actually got to meet him, you know. And I just basically took a bus and said, can I play here? And they put me between comedians, like when in the Gallagher days. And also I auditioned for the Gong Show, the original one. I'd like to get a hold of that tape.
How'd that go?
But they gave me $50 because it was 50 seats, you know, at the Ice House. And it was $1 a seat, and I'd play 15 minutes between comedians. And that's how I got into the music business, basically. I'd played, you know, a school before that in a bar when I was 13. And, you know, they paid me with a beer and all that. You heard about that. But my first professional stuff, I just kind of went out and did it and never stopped. And, you know, I lived the whole rest of my life doing all kinds of construction, come from a family of contractors. But I never stopped. That's why I'm so worn out now. I'm limping around now.
What do you remember very best from either? I had read the story about your starting off playing and being rewarded with a beer, but our listeners would sure love to hear it, and also from the Ice House.
Oh, well, the beer story is my sister saw that I had played my stepsister, and she was pretty wild chick running around town, knew all the bars. So she basically said, hey, let my little brother play. And they said, well, we can't have him in here. And she pretty much ordered him to let me play. So they paid me with a Michelob beer.
A 13-year-old.
I put it behind my leg because they said, don't let anybody see that you have that beer. So I'm playing, and now, in my mind, every time I play, if I'm standing, I'm worried about showing this beer in my mind. I stand a certain way. I think that's where my stance came from, is that beer. You know?
What else do you remember about that evening playing other than hiding the beer and you can't get caught with it?
Well, a guy took the jukebox. I was dressed up like Jimi Hendrix, you know, just really hippied out in kind of a country bar. And this guy just put some money in the jukebox and started playing Hank Williams and just blasted it. And I just knew to stop right then. You know, I think he was going to, you know, kill me and throw me out or something. It wasn't having any of this hippie music in there. But that's, you know, I got paid with the beer, my first professional gig. And I got paid actual money from the Ice House. And all at the same time. Started doing everything in one year.
What was your first Ice House gig like?
It was really fun. I couldn't believe it. And I went up there. It was pretty scary. You know, my parents didn't know I was doing this. And they put me on the stage, and I just watched a comic. And the comic was named Shoefly. And he was really funny. And so in the middle of, at the end, at the end of his set, I had to go and play. And I'm playing, you know, just folksy originals that sound like, you know, John Denver type of stuff. And I guess they just thought I was kind of a novelty. Look at this kid playing, you know. And then in the middle of my set, Shoofly comes back and starts using me as part of his comedy routine. So he's playing one of those little baby harmonicas behind my head and making fun of my curly hair. And I didn't know this. And then the audience is laughing and I realize what's going on. Oh, I'm part of the act. So I kind of went along with it. And he said, play some blues. And he started dancing. Then after the show, he says, hey, can you come on tour with me? Because I really like how this works, to San Francisco. But I was a little kid and I told my dad. He said, no way.
Oh, that would have been
amazing.
But
you know what? I probably should have gone, you know.
What an experience that would have been, too.
Oh, yeah. I would have either never come back or got really famous.
One or the other. What happened for you in 1976? I understand you went professional. How did you go from the Ice House and working with Shoofly to deciding, okay, this is it, I'm a full-time professional musician?
Well, I just started throwing concerts in my front yard, and I would set up chairs, and I kind of had to train all the neighbor kids how to play the instruments. And, you know, to be honest, I was way too nice to everybody for the first 20 years of my whole thing. And now that I'm 50, I'm too old to mess around. I got to play with top musicians, you know. And actually, I'm not playing live much anymore. But in those days, we had a lot of fun. And at that time, there wasn't a guitar player on every corner. I was the only one of three in probably a five-mile radius. And we had, I mean, the world was ours. We'd set up chairs in the front yard, and the neighborhood would fill them up and cheer you on, you know. And then years later, you can't make a sound or the police show up. So the world's a different place now.
It has changed so much.
But I just started and advanced and played clubs and did all that.
What did you mean by you were way too nice for the first 20 years of your career?
The musicians weren't that good. And to be honest, I mean, they were really trying, but I was doing all the work. I'd have to show them how to play. I'd write the song, show them how to play it, set up the rehearsal, even give them gear, show the drummer how to play, show everybody how to play. And then I should have just been doing it myself way back then, which I did. I started four-tracking and recording with boom boxes to get multiple takes. And I started multi-tracking my own songs. But I was just too nice. And this mostly has to do with the live aspect. You know, you're only as good as your weakest link. And at that time, great guys and all, but I should have searched out more professional players at a younger age. I probably would have had a lot more success. And now I'm just honored some of the guys I get to play with, and I've learned a lot.
Which leads me to ask, fast-forwarding to today, you had made a choice in 2010, I think, to go independent and start recording?
Yeah, what happened was I got involved with some old friends who were great musicians, and one of them was putting together a production called the Gentleman's Blues Club. And the concept was that he would get all these kind of all-star players and create a super band out of some semi-known and known players. And he ended up recruiting guys from Guns N' Roses and all these notable guys. And me, we were old friends since we were 15. And I contributed what ended up being like 10 out of the 16 songs were mine, and I played guitar with these other people. It was a combination. And he did three albums of that, and then he got some kind of record deal in Belgium with that. But that got messed up. That's a long story, but basically I won't ever see a penny from that. And it's just music business. And then I strayed away from that because I wanted to get my own thing going. And what happens, I saw a PayPal thing where you could upload your own music on it. And I uploaded this kind of a demo album where I played all the instruments. It was all the songs from the Voodoo Guitar album that I was working on. And then I get a phone call from Grooveyard Records because he's like looking for a washer machine on PayPal, comes across this and goes, oh, it's that guy from the Gentleman's Blues Club. He basically called me up and we talked for about an hour over the phone from New York. And so I was discovered by PayPal, and I signed a one-page record deal, and that guy's been a great label owner, and we get along really fine, and which is more than I can say for the big labels. Nobody gets along with the big labels. I have a nice small deal, and I'm really happy with it, and we're working on a lot of, now I'm on the fourth album, you know, with that label.
We should mention the website, grooveyardrecords.com.
Yeah, that's Grooveyard Records. They specialize in blues rock and heavy guitar mojo, as they say.